very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. On August 2nd, 1990, Iraqi troops invaded Kuwait. Operation Desert Storm began on January 15th, 1991, and would become the largest air campaign since the war in Southeast Asia. It was to be the birth of the concept of shock and awe and a test of the theory of how air power alone might be able to cause an enemy to capitulate. The U.S. and 40 allied nations flew more than 18,000 air deployment missions, 116,000 combat air sorties, and dropped 88,500 tons of bombs. After 6 weeks of air attacks, a 100-hour ground campaign liberated Kuwait. Jeff Tico Tice had a front seat on the action, but maybe not the ideal seat. On January 19, 1991, his F-16 was shot down, and he would become one of 23 prisoners of war of that conflict, enduring 45 days of captivity and torture as a, and I use the quotation fingers, guest of Saddam Hussein. I've heard Jeff's story in person, and I was so impressed that I felt we had to share it with our listeners. So welcome to American Warrior Radio, Jeff Tico Tice.
Hey, good morning, Ben. Thank you. I guess it's afternoon. Thanks for being, let me air. Excuse me.
Is it too late to get another guest, John? No? We're stuck with this one? Okay. Well, okay, thank you. That's the second time you corrected me today, and they've both been good corrections, although we're in multiple markets, so people listening to it might, yeah.
You're right. It could be.
We wouldn't dispute that. Jeff, let's start off. Tico, now it's a family show, and I found that very often pilots' call signs are not necessarily for broadcast, but Tico, in my mind, refers to it's slang for someone from Costa Rica.
That's exactly what most people think, but in fact, it's a bastardization of my last name. What happened was, as a young lieutenant, when you're first in the Air Force as a fighter pilot, you know you have arrived as a mission-ready pilot when your name is painted on the side of an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes your airplane, you have a crew chief, and you develop a relationship with your aircraft and your crew chief, and that's part of the beginnings of your Air Force career as a fighter pilot. Well, when I got to that stage in my career, I was flying the F-111, and it's a two-seat aircraft, so you have a weapons system officer, right-seater, co-pilot, if you will, and of course you have a crew chief, but you have more than one because it's a big airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came time to paint my name on the aircraft, they spelled it wrong. Instead of Lieutenant Tice, T-I-C-E, they spelled it Lieutenant Tico, T-I-C-O. Well, which was even more interesting, was that my right-seater's name, his last name was Angel, Greg Angel, and guess what? My crew chief's name was DeJesus. So when they painted that on the side of the airplane, someone took a picture of it. It showed up on the front page of the base newspaper during National Hispanic Month. Mm-hmm. Because you have Tico, Angel, and DeJesus on the... So from that point forward, it became Tico. And it's always been that way. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people don't even know my real first name.
Okay, well, vowels are funny things.
They
I
are.
Guess, sometimes. So why the Air Force? What inspired you as a young man to choose that course?
Oh, frankly, I kind of wanted to fly ever since I was about 7 or 8 years old. Grew up in Southeast Pennsylvania out in the countryside and in a small little quiet community. That was actually, you know, we lived out in the country. So the community was maybe 7 or 8 miles away from where I was growing up. We lived in a little valley, and on the top of the ridgeline behind us was an open field that, as I was a young man, started to become an airport. The guy who owned it literally plowed it, and planes just started landing there, you know, out of the blue. And as a kid, we would go up there, me and my friends who all lived within a couple miles of us, we'd go up there and just watch. And I got enthralled by the whole thing. And about the time I was about 10 years old, I got to fly in one of those airplanes as a passenger. And I just went, oh, this is just the way to do it. So when the time came for me to choose, I just said, I want to fly. And, well, Air Force kind of makes sense. That's all they do.
Yeah, they've got one or two planes.
Yeah, that's so it kind of made good sense to me.
Yeah, and that's a story I hear so often, particularly with the Vietnam era pilots who talk about, you know, barnstormers or just something like that. So let's talk a little bit about, sort of introduce the topic. I gave some numbers here, Jeff, and given what you've done to me so far today, I hope they were reasonably accurate, at least in the kill box, if you will, as far as numbers about Desert Storm. Tell us a little bit about I was kind of busting your chops coming in. You've got a very interesting license plate on your vehicle. Your squadron, the 614th Tactical Fighter Squadron's nickname is the Lucky Devils.
That is correct.
Except for you.
Well, no, I consider it just the opposite. A friend of mine once mentioned that I am a lucky devil on many different levels. And not just because I came from that squadron, the 614th Lucky Devils, but the fact that I survived several different opportunities to get rid of my life. Mm-hmm. I always tell people I've gone through six of my nine. I'm hanging on to these last three as long as I can. And that's the genesis of the license plate, was first of all to honor the squadron that I came from and all the guys who were in that place and in that unit throughout the years. And as a matter of fact, there's a gentleman that I know very closely who lives here in Tucson who was in the Lucky Devils in Vietnam in the early 60s. And so it was really, really, really a pleasure to have him. I'd take a photo next to that license plate. So one Lucky Devil is very important to me and a lot of reasons. And my wife is the one who said, you know, you really need one of those. Well, she got me the license plate.
It's a beautiful plate on a beautiful vehicle.
Thank you.
Very appropriate for a fighter pilot. Now, I've been warned by a mutual friend of ours, General Robin Baba Rand, not to do math in public, but I'm going to give it a shot. Basic algebra. The number of times you take your plane off from the ground should equal the number of times you land the plane, ideally with wheels and flaps. That didn't quite work out a little bit. We'll get into that a little bit more. But tell us about was it called Package Q or what that day's mission? I mean, just huge number of aircraft.
Right. It was the third day of the air war. And I say day, not night, the third day of the air war. And it was actually my second mission. And I was leading a package, a portion of that big package queue. I had eight aircraft, but with myself included. We had 16 airplanes from my squadron. Another one of my members of my squadron was leading the other eight, Nips Nichols. And the 16 from us, there were 32 F-16s from another squadron, actually another two squadrons in Abu Dhabi. And then you started adding all the support aircraft that goes along with it. There was somewhere in excess of 72 airplanes associated with this particular attack. There were three separate targets aligned in a line from southeast to northwest across the southern central part of Iraq and Baghdad. And the objective was for us to fly along the western side looking like we were coming hunting for Scuds at that time, because most of the Scuds were in along the Syrian border. And so we were just flying in that direction, and then everybody did a student body right, as we say, turn mm-hmm. a big right hand turn and fly to the separate targets and quickly attack all within a short window of time. Of course, if you all remember, the weather during the first week of the Gulf War was pretty crappy. And our rules of engagement, the ROE at the time said, if you can't see the target, literally, physically, with your eyeball, you can't drop in the certain area around Baghdad, which is where we were going.
Now, and this is prior to most of what we consider now smart bombs.
I mean, this is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, there were smart bombs available in the Gulf War, but we didn't use them. We always say we had smart pilots and dumb bombs. And it works out extremely well. The F-16, as you know, is extremely accurate weapon system delivering any kind of weapon. And especially, we were carrying Mark 84s, which are 2,000-pound bombs, and they're wonderfully good at creating a lot of damage. But the other good thing about the F-16 is because it can deliver this ordnance very accurately, you can pretty much do what you want with the airplane during an attack and be assured that it's going to hit where you put the pipper, as we call it, the reticle, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it right now. The death dot is what we really called it.
Now, Jeff, I've worked in previous lives in a lot of professional sports. I know baseball players tend to be a very superstitious lot. I don't know if that applies to pilots, too. But on that day of the mission, you ended up not in your plane. Does that cause any...
Huh? Well, the issue was, you know, my aircraft, the one that had my name on it, and this time they spelled it right, the one that had my name on it had a radio problem right at the start, and there was no time to mess around with it, and the spare aircraft was right next to me. My tradition and what I did as part of a superstitious pattern was that every time I did the walk around before we fly, you check every part of the airplane because that's all part of the procedural things that we do before we fly. One of the things that I always did is I spit in the exhaust. And I've been doing that ever since.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Yeah, I spit in the exhaust as a form of good luck.
Okay.
Well, I did that before I got in my aircraft. It had a radio problem. I couldn't be the flight lead without the radio. So even though we were doing most everything calm out, So I said, I can't do this. I have to have a radio. Jumped out of that airplane, ran to the other aircraft. The crew chief basically did one half of the walk around while I did the other half, jumped in the airplane. I never had an opportunity to do my traditional spit in the intake or spit in the exhaust for good luck. Therefore, the airplane didn't come back. And after that, my crew chief made everybody who flew with his airplane spit in the exhaust.
Fair enough. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined with Jeff Tico Tice. That was just the beginning of what turned out to be not a most excellent adventure for Tico. Stick around. When we come back, we'll talk more about how the algebra did not quite work out in this case. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined in studio by Jeff Tico Tice. Jeff was, unfortunately, one of 23 prisoners of war during Operation Desert Storm. He was flying an F-16 on a mission. If I'm not mistaken, Jeff, your target was an oil refinery, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, we were targeted against the oil refinery in the southeast corner of Baghdad. The river, the Tigris and Euphrates join together south of there, and they make a big bend in the river, and our oil refinery sits on that little peninsula. So it was pretty much, as we say, a Stevie Wonder target. pretty easy to find, well laid out. Not terribly close to any population centers, but there was an apartment complex directly across a four-lane highway just on the west side of that particular target. Excuse me. And of course, two guys in my flight had a maintenance issue, so instead of having eight airplanes come across that target, I was only able to take four to the bad guy side of the war for my particular target. The other aircraft all made it to their targets, but the weather was so bad they weren't allowed to drop because, again, I said the rule said if you can't see it, you can't drop on it because it's too close to population centers, and they were not terribly confident that we'd be able to not do something stupid and drop on friendlies.
So. Out of curiosity, we had a lot of nations involved in this action, but on missions like this, Jeff, I'm assuming it's just you didn't have any other allies flying with you. It was all U.S. correct?
Yeah, this was all U.S. The first 3 days, the first 72 hours of the war were essentially all U.S. When we got close to Baghdad, simply because we had the precision and the senior leadership was confident that we could do what we were told to do.
Now, up above the cloud cover, I think you mentioned 72 aircraft. That must have, and everybody's got to line up for gas, I assume, at some point. That must have been quite the sight.
Well, I still kind of get chills when I think about it because everything was done at that point. Once you clear the clouds and you're going to get your pre-strike refueling, yeah, nobody says a word. So from where I was at in Qatar, it's Q-A-T-A-R, but it's pronounced Qatar. We took off out of Doha, Qatar, climbed up above the clouds, went to our pre-strike tanker, and, you know, here you are on the Arabian Gulf, all the way as far as you could see to the west out to the Red Sea, were just nothing but airplanes that are getting gas, getting ready to go north of the Saudi Arabian border into Iraq. And It was just stunning to see how many airplanes and not a word was spoken on the radio. It was something that reminded me of the movies from World War II of thousands of airplanes circling overhead getting ready to go to Germany. It was a very similar experience where there was just, the joke at the time was there was more gas above the ground than there was under the ground in Saudi Arabia.
I love that. Now, was this for operational security purposes nobody was talking or just sort of the awe and the focus on what you're doing?
The combination of op security and just the focus is that we had been training to do this for so many years that people didn't even have to say anything on the radio. We knew it. Everybody had the right clock and everybody had good timing, and you just shut up and color, and it worked extremely well.
So you proceed on to your target, and tell me, I mean, we've all seen the movies and we know how accurate those can be, but when SAMs are launched, I mean, are you tracing them coming up in the sky in your general vicinity, or what does that look like from the bubble of an F-16 cockpit?
Well, in my scenario, in most scenarios, you'll get to see a burst of smoke from the rocket firing from the ground if you know they're looking at you. And we have enough electronic equipment in the airplane, you know, if you will, a radar detector, fuzz busters, whatever you want to call it. We have all that stuff in the airplane. Very sophisticated and well designed. You can tell somebody's looking at you. You can tell essentially where they're looking at you from, and so that gives your eyeball the chance to look at something, and you know when something is launched at you generally speaking.
So you've got a general vector.
You have a general vector, at least a quadrant to look at. I know that off to my left, off to my right, above me, below me, front, back, I have an idea where to look for something. In our scenario that day, the weather was so lousy. We had cloud layers, so there's a lot of moisture in the air. And what that does with an air, with a missile that's moving along at about Mach 3 to Mach 5, three times the speed of sound, five times the speed of sound, it's going to create a contrail or condensation trail behind it. So you can almost follow it from the ground all the way up to where it's going. And that was the best thing that happened to us, if you don't mind, is that you could follow the contrails and see where the missile was heading. And you had about 3 to 5 seconds to make a decision process from the time it launched to the time it got close to you. You have 3 to 5 seconds.
That doesn't seem like a lot of time.
Well, think about it. You know, we go 1,001. 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,000. That's a lot of time.
Okay.
Well. Now, think of an aircraft, we're traveling 480 knots. That's 520 miles an hour. You're doing 915 feet per second or 911 feet per second. So, you know, in five to seven seconds, you're going a long way.
You know,
so
I
for
stand,
us, that's a long time.
I stand corrected, Jeff, because I tell you what, I've had some radio shows where 5 seconds seem like forever.
Well, five seconds can seem forever in that kind of scenario.
So the post-action intelligence shows, I believe, that anywhere between 9 and 12 surface-to-air missiles were fired at you and your wingman, and you just were not able to... I mean, they got you.
Well, you're absolutely right. The post-intelligence folks told me between 9 and 12 missiles were fired at me and my wingman in less than a two-minute period over and around the target area when we were coming out of the target. I tell people that I had a 32-foot day, and they go, what does that mean? Well, because they're missiles, they don't have to hit you. They're not hit tiles. They're missiles. So what that means is all they have to do is get within a certain radius. If they explode close enough to your airplane, the shrapnel will shred your airplane. Well, that's what happened to me. According to the intelligence estimates, the type of missile that was fired near me and blew up near me was an SA-3, and they said, the intelligence agencies, finger quotes, said that that's about 33 feet is the lethal radius on an F-16 for that warhead, that size, all those things being equal. I had a 32-foot day. It just got one foot closer than it should have. Up until that particular missile, I had been dodging, I don't know, I dodged 4 or 5 of them at that point. So the aircraft was capable of maneuvering hard enough that the missiles couldn't get you, or at least they would get far enough away from you it wouldn't hurt you. This was 32 feet.
You were coming off the target. You had prosecuted the mission.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk. We've got just about, I don't know if we have time to get into it because it's a great description. I want to talk about that, what's going through your mind. We talked about time compression, how those things happen when, in your case, when you figured out that you were flying, I think you called it, Jeff, you look back and look like you had an exploding cigar behind you and just pieces coming off. And at some point you knew that, you're trying to get some, cover some distance going, which way, south then?
Yeah, we were going south, southeast at that point in time to get away from the hot spot.
And what amazes me, and you said in your presentation of the Distinguished Flying Cross Society, was you're trying to get as far south, in effect, kind of on a slightly powered glider at this point in time, because there was a beltway beyond which we were not rescuing people.
That's
and I
correct.
Was shocked to hear that. Tell us a little more about that.
Again, the rules of engagement at the time were, if you were more than 130 miles north of the Saudi Arabian border, we're not coming to get you, because we didn't have time to set up the forward operating locations and all that kind of stuff. So the helicopters, the C-130s, all the rescue guys, they just didn't have the range to come get you. So you had to get at least somewhere around 130 miles north or closer before somebody's going to come get you. So that was a big deal when my airplane got shredded and I realized that the engine was going to quit sometime soon. I just pointed as the shortest distance that I could find directly towards that border, because I knew if I could get there, I'd be okay. Somebody come get me. However, as you probably heard, I lost all of my navigational instruments during that time because things were burning and the airplane was coming apart. So I really wasn't sure how far it was to the border. I had a rough idea, but I still had one radio left, and I keyed the microphone and I asked the flight lead. I said, hey, how far to the border? The other flight lead, who was in front of me now. And he said 207, and I went, oh, this is going to take a little bit of effort. So realizing that I may have to eject somewhere farther north, I started taking care of all the necessary items in the cockpit and doing the pre-ejection thing in my mind. And I was running through all these checklists and had some classified documents that nobody really told me what to do with those in case we ejected, because it's like, geez, I don't want to leave them here. Somebody would find this stuff. Well, okay, so I decided I was going to lay it out on the top of my console so that when the ejection seat fired, the rocket motor would burn all those things up. Well, I did all this, and then I keyed the microphone again. I said, hey, how far to the border now? And there's a very long pause, 3 to 5 seconds. Very, very long pause, and he goes, 206.
Oh, boy.
So we had traveled exactly 1 mile during that whole process, and this is where that temporal distortion where time expands begins. You know, when you're in a tough situation, your mind begins to operate at its full capacity, and a second feels like a minute, minute feels like an hour, hour feels like a day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Jeff Tico Tice. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about mathematics and time and guys with AK-47s. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by Jeff Tico Tice. He's in the studio with us today talking about his experience during Operation Desert Storm. Jeff, before we took the break, I had the honor of hearing a presentation you made to a group called the Distinguished Flying Cross Society, and it was yourself and I want to say four others, POWs from World War II on through. I guess you were the equivalent of the present day representative on that. And just what an amazing presentation. I enjoyed it so much, which is why I wanted you to come here on the air and share it with our listeners. And what really struck me was your description of what happened then from that point where you decided, okay, it's time, I'm going to have to punch out. This aircraft's giving me all she's going to give me. And sort of there's, in your training, there's a process. There's a series of events that one has to go through to get out of an aircraft. Walk us through how that happened in Tico's mind.
Well,
and time.
Okay. The way to describe it is quite simple, is that when the airplane decides it's no longer going to be flying, it's time for you to give it back to the government in kit form. And that happened to me about 2 minutes after the actual missile exploded near me. So I actually flew the airplane for about two more minutes. And at that point in time, the engine had quit about 45 seconds before the airplane decided it wasn't going to fly anymore. And the F-16 is designed in such a way that when it loses the last little bit of hydraulic pressure, it saves just about 1,000 PSI, and it says, okay, I'm going to put the nose of the airplane up where it thinks up is. And that way you get an upward vector, so if you were low to the ground and you decide to eject, you're going to at least be going in the right direction. Well, that's exactly what happened. That last little bit of hydraulic fluid said, I'm going to start pitching up. Well, I was in the mid-20,000s, you know, I'm going to say 25,000 feet. I don't honestly know exactly where it was, but it was somewhere close to that. And the airplane starts pitching up, and I can't stop it, meaning I pushed forward on the stick. Nothing happened. Pushed forward on the stick the second time, and the third time, I broke the stick off. I swear.
Okay.
I mean, I may not have, but I pushed so hard, I probably did break it off. In my mind, I broke it. At that point, I grabbed the ejection handle, situated my body, get my back as straight as possible, and I pulled the handle, and absolutely nothing happened. The ejection handle only has a cable on it about 6 to 8 inches long, but I pulled it all the way to my chin. All that stuff. Well, the F-16 has a canopy that's made out of 2 to 4 inch thick optically clear Lexan, which means you're not going to go through it because it's too thick to break. It's designed not to break. As a matter of fact, it's designed to take a 5 pound bird at 500 miles an hour and not break. So you're not going through it. So the canopy has to come off first. That's the first thing that has to happen. And your ejection seat's not even going to fire until that canopy separates. Well, I pull the handle, nothing happens. And I'm thinking, oh, this day is just getting worse and worse and worse. And the airplane is pitching up. And I'm about ready to go over on my back. And the canopy still hasn't come off. Well, guess what? Everybody thought about this. The engineer said, well, there's a manual way to do it. You can reach over by your left hip and pull this handle, and it'll manually separate the canopy. Nobody's ever had to do that. Oh, well, I was going to be the first guy. And again, airplane's still burning. I'm not having a good day. I looked down, got my fingers around that handle, and I was getting ready to pull that handle when I look one more time, and I saw a little bit of air starting to appear between the rail and the canopy, and it's actually starting to separate, but my seat hasn't fired yet. And I'm thinking, oh. So my mind is racing, telling me that, okay, here's what you got to do next. You just got to wait. Just wait, wait, wait. Well, canopy falls off. I get a little bit of air rush. Now, I'm probably doing 200 miles an hour, but there really wasn't much air rush because I'm, you know, the airplane is sitting up vertically. The nose is pointed towards the sky, so the wind is actually hitting the bottom of the airplane. I'm pretty much being blocked by most of the airplane from the breeze. And I don't feel that wonderful little boost I'm expecting to see or feel getting shoved out of the airplane instantly and all kind of stuff. Nothing's happening. Now I'm almost on my back, and I finally feel like I'm starting to slide out of the airplane. Well, sliding is not what you really want to hear. You want to be shot out of that airplane. Well, finally, I start to fall away, and my brain says, you're not going fast enough. You're going to hit the vertical stabilizers. You fall down the back of the airplane. All these things are happening, and I'm just like, man, this is just not right. Well, the next thing I know, I get a big wiggle in the seat and a big tug, and I look down, and I'm out of the airplane. Well, from the time I pulled the handle to the time that canopy separated took 0.3 seconds. It actually happened exactly as the book said, but in my mind, it just wasn't going fast enough because the temporal distortion, that second felt like a minute. Mm-hmm. And it took about that long. The description was that's how long it took.
The mind is a pretty amazing thing. Ben gets a dumb question every show, and particularly with you. I've got lots of them, but let me... So at 20,000, 25,000 feet, what is... I mean, your goal is to get out of that aircraft as quickly as possible. What would be wrong with ejecting while you're inverted? What am I missing?
At those altitudes, there's really nothing wrong with being ejected as you're inverted. But what will happen is that the seat actually, the ejection seat actually has a gyroscopic, gyro-stabilizing device in it. It's going to try to get you back upright if it can. If there's enough altitude, it'll do that. It's pretty clever. The ACES-2 seat was extremely well-designed. It'll try to get you up. So ejecting upside down is not a big deal. It's just that you're going to be disoriented. Well, heck, you're going to be disoriented anyway, but you're going to be more disoriented when you come out like that. And the opportunity for pieces and parts to fall on you, you just don't want that to happen.
Physics are very weird things. I'm going to print a T-shirt for you, Jeff, that says ejecting upside down is not a big deal. How's that?
That's okay.
We'll sell dozens.
I'm sure we will.
So... Now Jeff has got some time to think about as you're drifting down over the lovely deserts of Iraq, and you see water.
Yeah.
And what's the first thought that crosses your mind?
Well, you know, I'm falling through the clouds initially, and I was only wearing my flight suit because, you know, hey, it was the desert. But at 20,000 feet, it's about minus 40, and clouds are made of water, so you're falling through the clouds. You're getting wet, and it's freezing on me, so essentially... I'm literally a frostbit ice cube as we fall down through the bottom of the clouds. And I finally fell down through the bottom of the clouds, and the parachute opened appropriately at about 14,000 feet. The problem is that between the time your parachute opens and the time you hit the ground, it's about 1 minute per thousand. So you got 15 minutes to think about this. Well, remember, my mind is operating at 15 minutes. It's like 15 days. Mm-hmm. And so I had plenty of time to talk and think about this. But as I came down through the base of the clouds, I could actually see the ground, and I noticed it was kind of marshy. And of course, in the desert where there's water, there's going to be people. And I didn't want to be anywhere near people. Now, the best part about this whole scenario was that the sun was going down, and it should have been, it should be down in maybe 15, 20 more minutes, but I had enough light to see where things were, and I could tell that there were large rectangular black objects on the ground that I didn't want to be anywhere near because they looked like somebody should be there. So I tried to steer my parachute away from it, but the wind was blowing extremely strong from west to east, and it was just not a good way for me to go. I just couldn't get away from it too far. So as I got closer to the ground, I started to see smoke rising from the nearby black rectangular objects. Turns out they were tents. And the smoke that was rising was actually not campfires. It was rifle fire. So these guys were shooting at me as we were coming down in the as I was coming down in the parachute. And I didn't want that to happen either, so I grabbed a whole handful of parachute riser and collapsed one half of my parachute so I'd fall a lot faster and swing back and forth like a bobbing duck in the shooting gallery because I didn't want these guys to have an easy shot. Luckily, that made me hit the ground pretty firmly, and I did, as they call it, the perfect parachute landing fall, PLF. I did toes, knees, nose, and got rid of my stuff, and I took off. I got about 3 Jesse Owens-sized strides out of the way before they shot up the ground around me, and I wasn't going anywhere fast because I had one 9mm, and these guys had semi-automatic, automatic weapons, and you know, I was pretty much outgunned.
And I tell you, I loved your description of the let's call it the Iraqi Chamber of Commerce Welcoming Committee. They were actually Bedouins, and tell us how you knew that they probably were not on. I mean, not the fact they were shooting at you as you're coming down, that they were not on our side in this conflict.
Yeah, as they came running towards me, they circled, made a big circle around me, and as most folks in that part of the world are wont to do. Their celebratory thing was to start shooting in the air, and I'm thinking, oh, that's really not a smart idea. Bullets go up, they're going to come back down. And as they got close enough to me, I took a quick look at who they were and what they were, realized they were Bedouin tribesmen, not regular army or anything like that. And the fact that they had no shoes, no teeth, but brand new AK-47s gave me an indication they were probably not on our side.
So you became their guest initially, and eventually were turned over to whom?
Well, I spent the first evening with my friends, the Bedouins, and then the next day they threw me in the back of an old Datsun B210 pickup from the 1970s, bumped across the desert at a wonderful 5 miles an hour for an hour, 3 hours, four, I can't even tell you how long we went, and they turned me into the local policeman in the small town of Samawa, which is kind of out in the middle of the flat plain south and a little bit west of Baghdad. And this gentleman was, to me, he reminded me of Jackie Gleason from Smokey and the Bandit. Big old rotund individual, small little .32 caliber pistol on his hip, spoke very good English with a decidedly British accent, was extremely hospitable in the fact that he asked me immediately if I had eaten yet. It was about lunchtime now. And I said, no, I hadn't eaten in, you know, 2 days or something like that. And he goes, oh, well, then we'll share lunch. So he actually went and got lunch, and the two of us sat in a little room, about one-third the size of this room that we're in here, sat in a little room with a little table, and we shared a meal. And he was, again, very hospitable. Never asked me a question, never was interested in anything other than, you know, had I had food. And then after the meal, he asked me if I needed to go to a bathroom. I said, oh, absolutely. And he told me, oh, just go down the hallway, make a left, and, you know, do that. So I went down the hallway. And
unescorted.
Unescorted.
Okay.
At the end, you know, there's this narrow hallway. The bathroom is at the very far end of the hallway. The opposite end of the hallway was a door directly to the outside world, right past what you would consider to be the desk sergeant's desk. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go down to the bathroom, get cleaned up. And I looked at the end of the hallway, and there was a little bitty window that I was not going to crawl through. So I thought, well, if I come out of this bathroom and there's nobody standing in a hallway, I'm going to blast out that front door and be gone. Well, I got out of the bathroom, walked down the hallway, and as I started walking, I was picking up speed, and about the time I was going to break into a run, somebody stepped into the middle of the hallway from another room, and I just immediately turned left into my little interrogation room.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, this story gets better, but we're running out of time. We got one more segment with Jeff Tico Tice. We're going to talk a little bit about his time in captivity and maybe some lessons learned, not just for him on resiliency, but also for our United States military. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very, very pleased to be joined in studio by Jeff Tico Tice. He was he still is an F-16. You're always an F-16 pilot, right?
That's true. You're never an X-fighter pilot.
Even if you return your aircraft to the United States government, a little scratch and dent.
Yeah, that's true. Rather large dent.
Jeff, unfortunately, we only have one segment left, and you're just such a great guy to talk to. I lost track of time, but your non-escape from a Jackie Gleason cop in just outside of Baghdad led to 45 days of some very interesting times. It's interesting when I listened to you and those Vietnam and the World War II POWs talk, I saw, as an outsider, I saw a lot of similarities. And I almost hate to say this, but it's almost like in that context of captors, the Germans were actually the nicest guys. I mean, the Vietnamese and our friends, the Iraqis, had never even heard of the Geneva Convention, much less read the thing. And you endured quite a bit of hard times over those next 45 days or so.
Well, yeah, there were some uncomfortable moments. There's no doubt about it. And just like you said, the folks who Spent 6+ years in Hanoi and endured some of the most amazing, uncomfortable times. So just I always tell them, hey, look, you know, 6 weeks doesn't compare to 6 years. One of my good friends, Bob Barnett, who was at that particular meeting you're talking about, he told me one day, he says, you missed the boring part. So, wow. You know, I guess I did miss the boring part because there were some exciting moments during my captivity. As you know, I spent 46 days up there, on the ground, 45 in, the hands of, Saddam Hussein's friends. And, you know, it's really not the subject of dinner conversation, but the best way to describe it is I lost 45 pounds in 46 days. That ought to tell you how things were run, which essentially means, I wasn't fed. The captivity was, while undercover, was brutal. You think, you're in a room, everything. Yeah, well, it's cold in Baghdad in February and January. You don't realize how cold it can be. And with just a thin piece of cloth on, you're freezing. So you're shivering constantly. I shivered constantly for 45 days in a room with no lights, no heat, no water.
And they're beating you. They're using electrical shock torture. They're doing everything they can to get you to talk. I find it interesting, Tico, that you mentioned that some of the questions they asked were things that someone could read in a aviation magazine. They weren't really even asking questions that would be tactically important, which gave you some flexibility to sort of make up some tales.
Right. Well, one of the things we learned from our experiences in World War II and Vietnam from the POWs is we actually learned that if you play, as we used to say, the John Wayne and you just do name, rank, and serial number, you're going to get killed. And that's not the objective here. The objective here is to resist to the maximum extent of your abilities and don't tell them anything that's of tactical importance if you can. So when they start asking questions that are, as you mentioned, are available in an aviation magazine, you go, well, this is easy. I can just weave a web of truth through all my other nonsense. And as long as you can maintain some level of mental acuity, you'll be able to remember that story even when you're under pressure because there's a web of truth through the whole thing. Now, once the pressure becomes a little too hard and you start losing consciousness and things fall apart and then you come back together again, you can actually remember a portion of that story and you won't be inconsistent, which makes your captors think that you've been lying the whole time, and they will not be happy about that.
One of the commonalities I also saw in your conversation with the other POWs was particularly in the Vietnam era, was their goal to get you to make a propaganda video, and you resisted that pretty well. But that's also one of the coolest parts of your story is finally they asked you if you would like to videotape a message for your wife and family. And the message that you gave was ingenious.
Well, once again, it was, again, a part of the training was resistance and then letting somebody know if you're forced into this situation to save yourself or save your comrades to make sure that everybody understood that this was not done at the freedom of my will. I was being forced to do so. So in that situation, they just said, hey, okay, you gave us what we wanted. Now we're going to give you what you wanted, which is you can get to say something to your wife and children. So I had been thinking about it as much as I possibly could, and I decided to just give them one phrase, and I said, the only real thing under recent examination is, I love you. Well, the only real thing under recent examination makes no sense to anybody until you look at the first letter of each word. And it spells out torture, the only real thing under recent examination. So that's what I used as a key to anybody else who would ever watch that video, which, by the way, I've never seen it, don't need to, that I wasn't doing this because I wanted to.
And the challenge in this, you know, Baghdad is a big city, but it's also a big target. The other challenge was while you are being tortured by your captors, your comrades are also dropping bombs on the building that you're in.
Yeah, that's true. I was in the, it turned out to be the Ba'ath Party headquarters, the secret police headquarters. I was in that place for the longest time, about 3 weeks. And night of February 23rd, my buddies in the F-117s came by and dropped 4 2,000-pounders on that building. So I've been on the giving end and the receiving end of 2,000-pounders. I like the giving end a whole lot better.
And that's just the nature of war, right? I mean, we had no way of knowing where they were holding you.
Now, it turns out, again, during the debrief, my intelligence debrief after I got back, that they, the ubiquitous they at headquarters, thought we were somewhere else. And they were going for a target in the basement. There was a bunker in the basement that they were going for the target. So they didn't even know we were there. And as a matter of fact, I'm kind of glad they did drop bombs because I probably would not have survived in that room, in that building for very much longer. There were several other people who were in very, very, very sad condition right about that time. But once that building got destroyed and we were removed from that building, oh, by the way, nobody was seriously injured in the bombing from the POW amazing. Side. It was totally amazing, which is another reason that I've got the one lucky devil license plate.
And I tell you, Jeff, you are probably the only guy I know who whose path to freedom involved the essence of Chanel No. 5. You really knew that it was time to go when they started bathing you in Chanel No. 5, huh?
Yeah, that's true. Well, as I say, well, I was in five different prisons during the time I was there, five different captivity places. The last place we were in, we called it the halfway house, simply because we actually could knock on the door and some guy would come to the door, open it, and let you go to the bathroom. Otherwise, you know, prior to that, it was just pick a corner. That was your bathroom. Well, the good news is you weren't eating, so there really wasn't a necessary very often. But once they opened the door, that cell one time, it told me to come out and turn to the right, and I saw everybody else lined up in front of me. We started marching down the hallway, and I saw a pair of double swinging doors at the end of the hallway. I just didn't really like that because this just didn't feel right. There was something wrong with this whole scenario of, that's the first time I'd been out of a cell without a blindfold on, without a bag over my head, and they're marching all of us down this hallway. I'm thinking, man, this is a firing squad just waiting to happen. The double doors swing open. We step out into this beautiful lobby. I mean, marble floor, chandeliers hanging, and thinking, oh my God, we're in the lobby of a gorgeous 5-star hotel, but we were in a cell just down the hallway. We turned left, started walking towards the entrance, and now remember, I'd been 5 weeks, 6 weeks without a shower and covered in concrete dust and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And away we went. We walked out, and at the bottom of the steps was a guy dressed in the wonderful Middle Eastern robes in gold, and he was spraying everybody with Chanel No. 5 because we smelled really bad.
A fragrant ending. Jeff Tego Tice, thanks so much for appearing on American Warrior Radio. We appreciate your time. Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast and others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.